Apparently, I can't call in. I can't
Love
call
Hope her. Radio.
Okay, can I, how about I hang up and call her?
Yeah, okay, go ahead. We're having a little communications problem, but welcome to Green Egg Radio Show.
Yeah, good evening. I'd like to welcome everyone to the Green Egg Radio Hour. We're having a little trouble getting a hold of our guest. I'm Sylvie Salou, and we are hoping that our special guest is going to be able to call in. Her name is Colibri Terry Sonnenblum. I believe I'm pronouncing that right.
That's right. That sounds, yeah.
And she's been exploring different forms of agriculture for the past decade. And most of her experience was as a bicycle-based urban farmer in Portland, Oregon, where she ran a CSA called Sunroot Gardens. CSA stands for Community-Supported Agriculture and is an arrangement where customers give a farmer a bulk payment up front in the spring for produce throughout the season. And in 2011, Colibri and farming partners moved to a rural location in Oregon's Willamette Valley to continue their experiments with growing food and medicine and saving seed. The Willamette Valley is famous as an agricultural breadbasket, but Colibri and her partners discovered that the reputation is undeserved. The area has been ravaged by chemical-based conventional farming, mostly for grass seed, for lawns and golf courses and things like that, and for Christmas trees. Only about 5% of the valley's farmland is used for food. Nonetheless, Colibri and partners were able to grow enough medicine and save enough seed to start a small online mail order company. That's called Dagawalla Seeds and Herbs. And in 2012, with no land to farm, Colibri and farming partner Nikki Hill spent the summer traveling around the Pacific Northwest looking for some place to settle and grow. Across Oregon and into California, they witnessed a once wild and pristine landscape ravaged by decades of clear cutting and ranching and resource extraction, now experiencing further destruction through the effects of human-induced climate change.
It was on this journey that they had the pleasure of meeting Phenicia Medrano, a.k.a. Tranny Granny, a Shoshone elder who still follows the traditional hoop. The hoop is a migratory form of agriculture practiced by the First Nations people for thousands of years, which was truly sustainable, but which has been nearly wiped out by genocide in its many forms. Currently, Colibri, I think I have this right, Colibri is working on a book with the working title Full Egos, Empty Stomachs, Awakening to the Food Crisis in the U.S., due to be released in spring 2013. That's a really great title.
It is.
Mm-hmm. So, Colibri, are you there?
I am.
Okay, great. Welcome. We're so thrilled to have you on the show tonight.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Yeah. Okay. So, Colibri, now, am I pronouncing your name right, Colibri?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's correct. Thank you.
Okay. What called you to food growing and seed saving?
It started pretty young for me. My parents were both gardeners, and so I had my first vegetable garden was when I was 6 years old, and it was one of these, you know, packets of the children's garden with a lot of different seeds in it, and I remember digging in the soil to plant this garden and found an Indian arrowhead, actually, that was white. This was in Omaha, Nebraska, in the mid-70s.
Mm-hmm.
And so it started. I think that it was basically my mom who kind of put the bug into me, and so I would always help out with the garden as a kid. And she tells the story of me stealing carrots out of the garden. I'd like fresh carrots so much I would sneak out there and pull up some carrots and wash them off and eat them myself. And she saw this happening, but thought, well, if that's what he's stealing, I'm just going to let him have his fun and that he's getting away with something. So that continued when I then as an adult, I did various, you know, sort of mainstream corporate things for a while. It wasn't until moving to Portland in the early 2000s that I tried to start gardening and then farming for other people. I guess I define farming as being different than gardening, and that you're trying to grow not just for yourself, but you know, for as much of your community as you can. And so that's where I got involved, not having any land of myself. Did a distributed network where I was setting up different farming plots on empty lots and in people's backyards and front yards and side yards all over the city, and then I used a bike to travel around among them and do the planting and harvesting.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if anybody else is experiencing this, but I'm having a bit of a difficulty understanding you, Colibri, and if you could talk maybe more directly into the phone, that might solve that.
Okay, how does that sound?
That's
much better.
Much better. Thank you.
Yeah, because I really want to hear what you have to say. So, okay. So, and like, what? When was this in your life? I mean, like, about how old were you when this happened?
When I was starting to do the urban farming in Portland. You mean, or?
When you, when this event happened that you're talking about, and when you got interested in gardening and seed saving.
Yeah, I mean, I started pursuing it as its own, you know, vocation or career or whatever you would like to call it in the early 2000s. So at that point, I was in my mid-30s.
Oh, okay. All right.
And, you know, the average age of a farmer in the United States is like 65, so that's still that's very young for a farmer.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Oh, the average age of a farmer in the United States is 60-something, so that
doesn't
might sound
surprise
like a late
me.
Start, but it's early for a farmer.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me because fewer and fewer people are going into farming for exactly the reasons that you're about to talk about tonight, probably.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, Calabri, tell me, what are your thoughts on urban farming, which is being heralded by some as the revolution?
Well, I know that in Detroit, Michigan, that there's a lot of very serious urban farming going on there. From what I've heard, from what I've read, and I actually have a friend there too that I've gotten news from, you know, directly from on the ground. So that's a place in the United States where they seem to be taking it very seriously. In other places, including Portland, there's been a lot of talk about it, but not very much action so far. In Portland, my own effort got a lot of local media attention, mostly because I was doing it by bicycle, and this is considered a very, quote, Portland way to do it, you know, very sustainable or what have you. And so there was a lot of press around urban farming for a few years there, making it sound like there was something really big going on. But in traveling around the city, looking around, you didn't see any you know, significantly larger number of gardens. We still found it difficult to find markets for our produce. The example that a lot of urban farmers are inspired by is Cuba, especially Havana, because after the Soviet Union collapsed, they no longer had the Soviet Union's help, like with oil and other resources. They were suddenly cut off from the world, really.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to stop doing conventional agriculture on a big scale, affecting organic agriculture, and they turned to urban agriculture as well. So at this point, cities in Cuba, including Havana, grow over half of their produce within their own city limits. And so that is truly a revolution there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, part of the reason they were able to do that in Cuba is because they have a very different government system than we do here, and different notions of private property. So it was sort of a top-down choice in Cuba in the interest of their own survival to have all this urban farming and organic farming happening. And that's not really how things would go down here with the system that we have here, especially of private property being what it is. So that's really, with the urban farming, I guess that I like to make comments about that just to say, okay, it's great that people are thinking about it. It's great that there's a few people trying it, but we're still very, very far away from doing anything serious or significant with urban farming in the United States with the possible exception of Detroit.
All right, Detroit. Yeah. Wow. So what did country farming teach you about the current state of agriculture?
Well, that was that.
That was quite a
disillusioning experience because, you know, living in Portland, you hear a lot about what a rich and fertile agricultural valley the Willamette Valley is, you know. And
mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, when you know, the Europeans, you know, first invaded the area, I think that that was probably true. However, the way that farming has happened there since then, especially since the so-called Green Revolution of the 60s, which is very heavily dependent on chemicals, on monoculture, on clearing everything, fence to fence, et cetera, what's happened since then is that the valley's been greatly poisoned, you know, and its landscape has been really changed, too. Over 90% of the wetlands in the Willamette Valley have been destroyed or altered, for example. Of course, you know, most of the area where there's been forest has been cleared by. And then in the agricultural land in the Willamette Valley itself, over half of it is for grass seed for, you know, houses, golf courses, you know, the little strips along the parking lot at the shopping mall, you know, this is what it's for, and then Christmas trees. So when we were out there trying to grow food and medicinal plants, we found out that, well, most of the land is not being used for food. Only 5% of the Willamette Valley is being used for food. And the land there is also just hammered, you know, by years of chemicals and then also
mm-hmm.
very heavy machinery that, you know, tend to compact the soil
mm-hmm.
and all that. And so what we found was that this, you know, rich agricultural, you know, fertile place, you know, was no longer rich and fertile. In fact, it's all just in need of some restoration at this point.
Yeah.
Mm.
That is horrifying because I lived almost all my life in California, in Northern California. And, you know, I know what Oregon looks like. And it used to be just vast stretches of forest. I mean, that's all you saw were forest. Now, I'm told, because I haven't been up there in years, that there's trees along, like, the highways, but behind that, it's just been clear cut.
Yeah, you see that a lot. I've heard them called idiot strips, or a little more diplomatically, beauty strips, where they have them. It's just you know, maybe trees for 50 feet deep along the road, and then yeah, if you look carefully, it's mostly clear cut behind there. I think that the amount of forest in Oregon considered old growth is around 5% at this point of what was originally there.
Right, and I think in California it's about 3% of. Only 3% of the redwoods are left in California that used to be up there. Yeah, and for our listeners, if you've never been to Oregon or if you've never been to Northern California and seen the wonderful old-growth forests and vast stretches of woods that are disappearing, it's really hard to comprehend the magnificence of the landscape. And then when you see it, it's just, it's been raped. The land has been raped.
Yeah.
Yeah, because seeing the redwoods that are still there is a deeply moving experience.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I lived in the redwoods for a while. And it was a magical, wonderful experience. It was really wonderful. Oh, boy.
The air in the redwoods is just sort of drenched with life somehow. I remember
mm-hmm.
when I visited there, just breathing there feels different, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's the air is so healthy and it's just really nice when you're in one of those forests like that. And it's really heartbreaking. It's absolutely heartbreaking to me every time I hear about something like this. And that's one of the reasons we've got you on the show, because we want to get the word out to people, you know?
Yeah, what he's talking about kind of reminds me of what, you know, what's going on in our state as well with all the stripping of the Appalachian Mountains.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, that drastically changes the soil, and the same thing that's going on there is also going on here, and I suspect it's going on many places in this country.
Mm-hmm. Well, throughout the Appalachians, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, and they don't just, they do mountaintop removal for coal, but that's not it, not all. They also strip out rocks. And
yes.
Believe it or not, people will pay like $3,000 for a boulder to be shipped to California to put in their front yard for a decoration. I mean,
yeah,
you know. And we had just right up the road here, I don't know, maybe 2,000, not even that, 1,000 feet up the road, we had a guy in here who owned a rock thing, a business, and he was mining for rocks for several years, and it was horrendous. I mean, we were just about ready to sue him because we live in the Appalachians, you know, we're talking 90 degree angles here on the mountains.
Mm.
You want to talk erosion, you know?
Yeah,
so
that's bad.
This kind of thing is happening all over the country. They might be doing different things to the land, but the land is not healthy.
But still, it's stripping the trees, and there's a vast difference. I grew up in the forest,
mm-hmm.
and planting your medicinal things in the forest is far different than trying to plant it on something that's been stripped and fertilized and
mm-hmm.
and used for pasture, you know, like what he's talking about for the golf course things. It just strips the nutrients, and it's not sustainable for medicinals and just wildcraft plants,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
And the restoration, boy, that takes some time.
A long time.
Yeah. Well, one thing I'd like to ask is, what was it like for you to meet Tranny Granny?
Well, meeting Tranny Granny was an amazing experience because as a person, she's just very, very different than most people that you will meet in the United States. She's very unconventional, and it has been for a long time. And talking to someone the thing that really stood out was that she just doesn't really lie. She's not trying to put on a particular face. She doesn't really care about any of the conventions of you know, tact, you know, or how you're supposed to talk to people and sort of coddle their egos and be
mm-hmm.
polite and, quote, not saying anything negative. I mean, she's just not like that at all. She's been living outside, you know, for 3 decades, seeing all this destruction. And so for her, she needs to speak directly about all of this in order to be honest with herself and to be honest with the world. And it was also, you know, just amazing to detect and to feel how much of this came from a very deep love on her part, you know, for the living creatures, you know, for the living creature that is the planet, you know, and to see how an expression of anger can also be an expression of love.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
Yeah, and which is a rare thing, you know, and in you know, in American society, you know, and it varies a little bit from subculture to subculture, we often spend most of our time sort of dancing around our true feelings or dancing around the feelings of the person that we're talking to and not really wanting to be direct and wanting
mm-hmm.
to project a certain image of ourselves or wanting to respect the image that someone is projecting of themselves, even though you can tell that it's not true. And, well, she just simply doesn't live in that world at all. And so it was a breath of very fresh air, one that I could see that also many people might not appreciate in the same way. And yet, the need for such direct truth telling is essential in our times for understanding these things. And so, I was very grateful for the experience of being able to meet someone like that.
Yeah, it sounds absolutely refreshing to tell you the truth.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? Americans, as a culture, I think we're not real good at looking at reality, you know,
yeah.
trying to find out what's real. Oh, boy. Did you want to say anything else about Tranny? Well, first of all, Tranny Granny. How did she get the name? That's an unusual name.
Oh, well, she also is a tranny. She was born as
okay.
As a man. and had the surgery at some point. I'm not sure when exactly. You could read, she has a book that she wrote called Growing Up in Occupied America that gives her biography, but I know that she grew up in the 60s as a young person, says that she was one of the original acid queens back then. So I think that it was in the late 60s, early 70s sometime that she made that transition with the help of a friend who paid for the surgery, and that was not nearly as common then. So you meet her now, and she's a beautiful older woman, but she was born a man. So yeah, Tranny Granny was a name that was given to her, I think, by the radical fairy community in Oregon, in Wolf Creek.
Okay.
Might have heard of Wolf Creek. Yeah.
Well, we have a radical fairy group out here that lives in Tennessee.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I know some of the people that live there, so it's funny how I found you. But, you know, in my spiritual path, we honor the trans people, you know. They're magical. They're really magical. They walk between worlds.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, and this is you know, I also heard some of that lore while visiting her about how, you know, and not, you know, people not just tranny, but, you know, who you would call queer or you know, or gay or any of these other terms, who also were seen that way and had their special roles in different tribes. And that of course, is also very different from a modern American culture.
Oh, yeah, really. Very much.
I mean,
so.
You know, in this culture, you know, okay, so some laws are getting changed and you know, people who are not heterosexual are sort of getting consolation prizes now that they're, you know, oh, okay, now we're not going to fire you from this job, or now you can get these domestic benefits or et cetera. But in, you know, in a lot of ways, that's just absorbing rebellion into the system and then neutering that rebellion rather than learning anything from it.
That's a good way to put it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Neutering it, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I think this happened in the 70s with the women's movement and with other you know, identity politics focused movements, you know.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Well, look, you know, we're not racist anymore. There's, you know, a person with dark skin in the president's office, so we can stop thinking about that now, you know.
So, what were some other things that you learned from Tranny Granny? I mean, I would imagine there was just a wealth of information that she had.
Yeah, and we were there mostly to find out about the plants and see the plants and find out how to care for them, how to harvest them, how to eat them. And so that was most of the time that we spent with her. And, of course, that was an incredible experience because if you don't know how to look, you just are not seeing any of these things. You know, and she would take us to these, you know, desolate-looking places, and it was, I don't know, I think it was August or something, so, you know, it was very hot, very dry, everything's desiccated, and it just doesn't look like anything at all at first, and then she would take us out there and be like, oh, look, see, this is Yampa, here's the seeds, they're ready to harvest, and once you saw one plant, you know, well, then you'd see dozens, or then you'd see hundreds, and they were everywhere, you know? And, you know, we learned, for example, that out there in the desert, there's actually more food growing than there is in an old-growth forest. You know, in an old-growth forest, there's not much sunlight that reaches the ground. There's, you know, you're not finding berries. You're not finding very many plants that are edible, you know. And so if you're out wildcrafting for food, the desert is a better place to go than the forest in many cases, you know. And so just seeing... learning how to see these places or start to see these places in a new way and to see all these new plants is amazing. And then after we left visiting her, we're traveling around other parts of Eastern Oregon and Northern California where we saw these same plants other locations too. I mean, we got good enough that we could see them even when driving by. Oh, stop, there's some loops or whatever. And so, you know, just to get a different view of the landscape. And the plants themselves, you know, we ate some of the yampa, some of the seeds you can eat. They also call it wild caraway. The flavor is somewhat like caraway. You can eat the roots, the tubers, and eating the fruit just feels much different than eating, tamed, tamed vegetables, because there's a wildness in the food that you can, it just feels different, I guess you would say, energetically, it feels differently, and it just made me feel different in my own body than, say, eating, a domestic carrot would or something like that,
Mm-hmm.
And so this was really a valuable part of spending time with her too, is seeing how eating those foods makes you feel different. And I can, she claims that, if you've been out on the road, out on the hoop, once you've been eating these wild foods and nothing else for 40 days, that the animals start to treat you differently then, because you smell different, your senses start to work different. And so probably these foods are a gateway to being more fully human.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was the thing that just leaped right at me. How I found you, of course, was I happened upon your article, and that just blew me away, that if you eat wild food, the wild animals will be okay with you. They'll be drawn to you. And I wondered why that was. So you're saying it's a smell?
I think part of it's the smell, and part of it is that, you're just sending out different vibes at that point, because you yourself are feeling different and are living in a different way too. So there's not as much of a difference between you and them at that point, and they can tell.
Now, what about? I'm curious about something. Is deer, for example, do not eat meat, and so what if I'm on a wild diet, and I eat? I'm not going to do this. I don't hunt, but I went hunting and caught a wild turkey and ate that. Would that make a difference for them?
Oh, I don't know. If you want to talk about more specific things like that, you should probably talk to Tranny Granny yourself.
Ah, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
I just thought that was just fascinating, that the wild animals will be attracted to you if you're eating wild food. And it never really occurred to me to go on a diet of entirely wild food. Yet, with as much ruin as we've had up here in this area, there's still tons and tons and tons of things growing on our land, just wild. We don't mow our lawn. We don't do any of that stuff. We let all the herbs and plants grow, because every single one of them has, it's either medicinal or you can eat it.
That's true.
That's a great start. And Tranny Granny talks a lot about rewilding. It's a big word that she uses over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that's what you're doing there. Pure Land is letting it rewild.
Well, one thing I can answer for you, Ariel, is, as you know, I grew up in the Appalachians, and mm-hmm. Where we hunted our own food, raised our own food, and
mm-hmm.
and of course went into the mountains for our medicinals.
Mm-hmm.
We also would hunt deer, wild turkey, and things like that. But now the animals are eating the plants, the same things that he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you consume that, you're still consuming what the animal consumed.
Got it.
And there's really no difference there, as far as that goes, because you are what you eat,
mm-hmm.
literally.
Yeah.
And it's just nature, of course, nature teaches us, and you see it even in places like Africa and the Serengeti. The wild animals, they only kill when they have to eat. It's not a sport.
Mm-hmm.
It's not fun. It is of necessity.
Mm-hmm.
So, there is a big difference there, especially with the energies that you're taking in and what you're putting off. You're not doing it selfishly.
Mm-hmm.
You're not being mean. You're not being ugly,
Mm-hmm.
As long as it falls in the line of nature, the animals will still sense that.
Mm. That's just wild. I don't know why, but that just utterly blows me. Well, I grew up in the city. I grew up in Los Angeles and, moved here to the mountains of Tennessee about 8 years ago. I couldn't handle cities anymore. But it just blows me away, and I'm just fascinated by the wildlife. I'm out here all the time observing the wildlife. I'm feeding the birds out on my front porch, and I've counted about 30 species. And that's after this area has been decimated.
Yeah,
but
they'll come wherever they, you know, they feel safe, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, this whole area, all the land all around here, all the neighbors, people used to hunt all the time, but nobody that lives here now hunts. And so gradually the animals, very slowly, the animals are getting a lot more used to us. The deer don't startle as much when I open up the front door. And they'll stay there for a little while, you know, when I come out, things like that. But seems to me that, this is just my belief, that when humans were first on the earth, I believe we could communicate with animals telepathically. I think we've lost much of the ability to be telepathic. But I think at one point, perhaps, we were on far better terms with wild animals. And now they just don't trust us, for good reason.
No, they can read us, the energy we put off. We may have lost it, but they haven't.
Yeah. They're real good about knowing who they can trust, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Yeah. Here's something I'm wondering. Can the traditional methods of the hoop be utilized to feed our modern society and its large population? And if so, how would one go about doing that?
Yeah, this is obviously something I gave a lot of thought to, seeing the land out there and seeing these foods. And I know that one estimate is that the population of the Americas before the European invasion was as many as 100 million people were living in North America.
Mm-hmm.
But at this point, it's a lot more people than that. I mean, the population of the United States is approaching 400 million.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know, once you throw in, you know, Mexico, Canada, et cetera, it's considerably more people than lived here before, you know, sustainably. And, of course, besides the wild plants, there were also the wild animals. I mean, famously, the buffalo, you know, the herds were in the millions and millions and millions and were wiped out almost entirely in about a 20-year period, you know. So it's hard to imagine that we would be able to stop, you know, all agriculture and just go out and eat from the yampa and stuff because, well, there isn't as much of the growing out there as there once was, and there aren't as many, you know, there's certainly not nearly as many buffalo. I mean, it seems like kind of a hopeless situation, and yet it is a real thing to look at because when you look at the last few years here of climate change and you see how conventional agriculture is being affected, you can see that the conventional agricultural system in the United States is beginning to fail. You know, the flood, you know, in 2011, I guess that was, you know, that took millions of acres in the Midwest out of food production that are still out of food production because they got polluted so badly or because they got buried in silt or et cetera. And then this last summer we had, and in 2012 we had, you know, the tremendous drought, you know, and the amazing crop failures that were happening then. And I remember at the end of when we were still traveling in, I think it was September, we noticed that there was, that in all the grocery stores you went to, that beef was on a steep discount, a big sale, and pork was on a big sale. And a friend of ours, you know, we talked to, said that, oh, yeah, the reason for that was because the crop failures in the Midwest were so terrible that it was driving up the prices of the feed. And so the ranchers of the pigs and the cows could no longer afford to buy feed for their animals, so they were killing a whole bunch of them off early.
This
included the animals that maybe were even going to wait until next year or something like that. So that's why there was this sudden glut in the market in beef and pork this fall, because they couldn't even feed those animals, you know, anymore. And so they're expecting there to be very high prices, you know, on both of those in 2013. There's going to be a smaller supply. And, of course, the cost of the feed would be a real rise in cost at that point. It went up this summer because of the, you know, because of the speculative markets around it. You know, the there's the, I can't remember the term right now, but the you know, where there's the commodity trading. That's what it is. And so oh gosh, there's going to be a short supply. So even though we still have a decent supply now, the price is going to go up in anticipation of a short supply next year. So the price already went up in anticipation of a shorter supply. Now this next year we will have a shorter supply. So, I mean, for the United States to change its diet and even begin to think about approaching a wild diet, the United States will have to eat far, far less meat than it currently is, you know, in all categories. Mm-hmm. The amount of farmland that's being taken up just for feed for these animals is in the majority, you know?
It's not a sustainable practice.
No,
I mean, 70% of the public lands in the nine western states are being used for ranching, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know,
yeah.
And that's for cows. And those cows make up, you know, less than 5% of the market, of the total, you know, cow, like, the meat market in the United States. You know, in the meantime, all those cattle in those 70% of those federal lands are, you know, continuing to trample and destroy what remains of some of the native foods out there. So there's no real reason economically why we even need to be raising, you know, cows out there. But in the meantime, back in the Midwest, well, we're not going to be able to do it there, you know, either. So I think that you know, some people in some places will be able to return to wild food sources, you know, in order to get by. But, I mean, what are they going to do in Los Angeles, you know?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Or Atlanta or New York City or Chicago or, you know, I mean, I have no idea what's going to happen in these places. As much as I am sort of sickened by the destructiveness of our culture, at the same time, I can't wish for the sort of suffering that seems inevitable in order for it to change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hear you on that. It just seems to me that our culture at this point is we're in a bind. You know, we're looking for free energy, and so far we haven't had that. You know, it's like our food supply, our energy supply, it's like everything. We've got shortages of everything and shortages of water on the planet now, too.
Yeah, well, a lot of that is due to, you know, greed.
Mm-hmm.
These corporations are buying up the available aquifers, the land that holds that, and it's going to come to the point where I believe that, you know, we're going to see water prices, you know, per gallon like we do milk.
Mm-hmm.
And just think about that with having to take a shower or wash your clothes.
My heavens, yeah.
Yeah.
Really. It's yeah.
Yeah.
So that brings us to the next question. Or, Don, did you have a question? I'm sorry. Did you have a question?
Well,
before?
I was just wondering what do you see in the future of agriculture?
I mean, I think that at the moment I don't see anything that I would call very hopeful. In that there's just not enough awareness yet of the fact that all of these things need to change. You know?
Yeah.
You know, so when the I think that there'll probably be some period of time when probably the government will have to step in and take over a lot of agriculture just in order to keep people fed, to keep them from rebelling.
Uh-huh.
This is the practicality. I think that's probably something that's going to end up happening. And, you know, there's been different executive orders signed by the last few presidents, Republicans and Democrats alike, you know, that give them special powers in emergencies, which includes seizing farmland and seizing food and, you know, to make sure that it's distributed well. So
yeah.
I think that, you know, that's going to be an in-between step that happens there. You know, probably there'll be other things do go along with that, like, well, in order to get this through from the government, well, you'll need to have, you know, biometric identification, you know, et cetera. You know, it'll be it'll be something that they'll be able to use for continued, you know, social control, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyone who can find any way of providing for themselves and their community so that they can remain free of the government, you know, and free of these large institutions. I mean, there's really not much of a difference between government and corporations at this point, you know. I mean, that's just going to be a better way to live for those people who are able to do that, you
mm-hmm.
know. But I think that, and as to the long haul, I mean, I don't understand how any of it's going to work itself out without a lot of people dying, probably.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, probably there's just going to be some kind of die-off. You know, and as I said, this is not something that I wish for. Despite the things that I see in the world, I still don't hate people, you know, and don't want to see suffering. But it doesn't look like there's much of any other way of getting around it on the grand scale. And I think that on the local scale, I think that in certain pockets and in certain little areas, I think that there's people who will be able to get by. But, you know, all of that work, you know, needed to have started yesterday, you know, like,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, like figuring out, okay, what are the wild fruits in my area? You know, how do I identify them? How do I tell them apart from the poisonous plants? When do I harvest them? When do I not harvest them? How do I feed them? And besides that, okay, in the meantime, the domestic crops that we have around that are easy to grow, et cetera, well, how do we do that, you know? I mean,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, you look at an American diet and something like 85% of the diet is coming from, you know, grains and beans, you know? And,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
you know, like, you know, all those sort of row crops, you know, the big row crops, you know? So, you know, having a vegetable garden, well, vegetables and fruits are only something like 15% of the diet, you know? So
mm-hmm.
a vegetable garden's not going to do it. It's like, well, you know, okay, great, you grew some nice tomatoes for your pasta, but, you know, did you grow the wheat to make the pasta?
Well, yeah, that's
you're
looking at more than just
yeah.
growing there. You've got to be able to mill it, you
yeah.
know. And I don't
yeah.
know of too many people that are willing to get a big millstone and use the energy to push that thing and grind it down. You know.
Well, they used to have the town, you know, like for a town, they had the miller with the millstone, you know?
Yeah.
They
yeah.
used to. And
yeah.
I'm hoping that we go back to that soon. In fact, I've been looking into what kind of grains can I grow. And that's when I discovered, you know, here, with where I don't have to go through a huge process, and that's where I discovered that we had wild amaranth growing, also known as pigweed. Also,
mm-hmm.
the thing that everybody tells farmers they need to get rid of. But it's wild. All you got to do is go out and pick it, and that's it. There's your food, you know.
Yeah,
and
that's just the thing is that a lot of people, you know, they buy these poisons to get rid of all these weeds in their yard, and they're not aware that those weeds are actually food stuff.
Mm-hmm.
These are
yeah,
things that they could be harvesting, and some of it you could can, some of it you could freeze,
mm-hmm.
some of it you could dehydrate.
And medicinals, all the wild
yes.
herbs that are medicinal as well.
Exactly.
Yeah,
because I've heard that there's some evidence now that dandelion can be used to fight cancer.
For cancer, that I didn't know. I know.
Yeah, I mean, just to mention the most hated weed.
Yeah, I know people that I love them. They're really, really good for your liver. And these days, with all the pollution in the air, we need... You know, we need our dandelions. And
yeah.
they also help women to balance their hormones too. And you know all about that, Sylvia. You were raised with that. I mean, your grandmother taught you all about using herbs and...
She taught us. I've got a lot of her... She wrote things down as she got older. And one thing I do remember, and it kind of goes along with what's happening today with such things as birth control and abortion and things like that. Now, the women in my family were very fertile,
and she had certain herbs that she would gather and make a tea out of. And I mean, this was just, you know, four or five different herbs that she would, she'd steep in hot water. And every morning, the women of the family drank a cup of that to keep from getting pregnant. And, of course, she, if any of us, this was especially true with me with my early years, you know, if we became irregular, she had a brew that she would make up, and, you know, you drink this every day for 10 days, and let's get you straightened out. And it worked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she had a very... she was very knowledgeable, you know, like what he's talking about. There's a certain time you pick it. There's a certain time you use the root. There's a certain time you use the top of the plant. You can either use the flowers, the leaves, maybe a combination of both. But you've got to know what you're doing, because if you just go out and willy-nilly pick something, you're going to poison yourself. So, you know, there's going to be a need in the future, I believe, for people who know exactly what they're doing. And I believe if, you know, people got back to eating the wild things and using what nature provides, we probably wouldn't have a lot of the allergies we have today.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that one there. Yeah, and one of the things I wanted to ask is if Tranny Granny could speak to the entire world, what do you think that she might tell us? What words of wisdom would she pass on to us?
Lately, the last time that I talked to her, what she was wanting to talk to people about was that this spring, she's welcoming anyone who wants to join her for a portion of the hoop in Eastern Oregon, because really, for her, you need to experience these things in order to really understand them. She talked about having a credibility availability gap, where she's really only credible when she's out on the hoop doing this work, but then she's not really available to many people to teach them. And then when she's, you know, taking some time off and she's available, well, now she's not doing that work. She doesn't feel as credible, you know, which is certainly being, you know, more honest about you know, what she knows and how it is that she knows it than most people are being, you know. And so I know that this spring, I believe in the beginning of April, people can join her, and she's in Hell's Canyon in Eastern Oregon to start with, and she'll be working her way across Oregon, west across Oregon, to different locations, you know, to you know, to live that life, to encounter those plants and those animals and these different ways of thinking and these different ways of being, and et cetera, you know. And she's pretty easy to find on the internet. She can be found on Facebook, and you know, you can just call her up and say, I want to join you on your journey. Where can I meet you?
Do you have that phone number handy that you can let our guests know?
Yeah, I can look it up on the phone here while I'm talking to you. So give me just a moment.
Okay, great. Because I know several people already who would be real interested in doing something like that, I'm sure. And
yeah, that would be a good experience for anyone to have under their belt, you know. At least it gives you a start, you know, on knowing where to look and how to look and how to start your own investigation and or getting to know what plants are in your local area.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe right out in your front yard.
Mhm. Yeah, it's amazing what people have around, you know, just on their front yard or whatever, that are edible. My niece came down to visit about 2 years ago, and she and her husband are heavily into foraging. And, you know, if there's three plants, they take only one. You know, they only pick one out of every three plants. She took us all around our land, and she showed us, I can't even begin to count how many herbs and foodstuffs, you know, that plants that we have. I mean, if civilization fell apart, we would be eating and probably be pretty healthy with all of the things that are growing around here. Like, I didn't know you could eat, what are those, red buds, red bud flowers. Red bud flowers. They're delicious. And all of the those things that are called weeds have medicinal value. And I don't know.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah, I don't know how they came to be called weeds and useless, but.
Well, it's because big agriculture can't use them.
Yeah.
You know, if big agriculture or mega corporation can't use it, then it's useless to them. But that's okay, because what's useless to them is very useful to us.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, when you start talking and learning about indigenous cultures, you realize how much we have lost in our culture. I mean, most people have no clue as to how important it is to be connected to the land.
Exactly right.
And
I think that most people haven't had the experience of being connected to land.
Right.
You know, period. You know, I mean, if you are growing up, you know, as you said, you know, in L.A., for example,
mm-hmm.
Well, where's the land to connect to, you know?
Right. But there isn't any. And the parks, when I was growing up there, I'm 58, so this is like 45 years ago, the parks were way too dangerous even then to go into. So you couldn't even do that. And it's, I think the field of psychology actually has a name for this, but I can't remember what it is, in people who've lost that connection to the earth. And to me, it's like when we do that, then we're orphans. We lose track of how important this earth is to us and how we really need to take care of it and be mindful.
I found Tanny Granny's number if you'd like to hear it.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's
I'll repeat it a couple times. It's area code 541.
Okay.
480.
I'm sorry, what's that number?
933.
48.
It's area code 541.
Uh-huh.
480-0933.
Okay, that's 480-0933.
That's right, yeah, and
okay.
She really does invite anyone to, she makes that number public, and so you're free to call her there, and it's, yeah, starting in April, and
mm-hmm.
she's going to have this month-long walkabout on a portion of the hoop, and people are going to go by horse and by foot and by bicycle.
That's
by
wonderful.
Foot, by bicycle, and by what?
And by horse and by foot.
And by horse. Oh, wow. And this is a whole month. It's a walkabout, like, for a whole month, like a vision quest.
Yeah, or even more than a month. I think it's going to be a few months long, but you could just come for any part of it if you wanted to.
Wow. John, you ready to make reservations on the plane?
I would love to.
Yeah, so would I.
I would be in a totally different territory, though, so it would be a new learning experience for me. Cause I'm from, you know, of course, I'm familiar with my home area.
Right.
But
very.
I mean, I think what she's doing is wonderful, and
mm-hmm.
I'm in hopes that whoever connects with her, you know, if they come from a different area of the country, will take what she teaches them and go to their area and continue that work.
Mm-hmm. Continue learning. Yeah. Yeah.
Coast to coast would be wonderful.
Now, we've only got a few more minutes, but before we end, I wanted to ask you, Calibri, if you would give us your information about your company, Dagwalla, that you have established, and where we can find you on the Internet and all of that kind of stuff. You want to tell us a little bit about Dagwalla?
Yeah, myself and a couple of farming partners started a seed and earth company that we call Dagwalla, and
mm-hmm.
we sell seeds for domesticated plants and few wild plants, which we started adding after meeting Tanny this year, and adding some of those seeds to our collection. We also make herbal medicines like tinctures and salves and facial scrubs and all these sorts of things,
mm-hmm.
and you can find us at dagwalla.com, which is dagwalla.com, and we have a sale on there, some of the seeds that Phoenicia introduced us to, this summer, and when we're selling those seeds, we're actually going to donate 100% of the proceeds from those seeds to her and to her efforts to help people rewild and to help find some different land and some places like that. So we really want to help get attention to what she's doing and, you know, get more of these seeds, you know, out there and get more of these ideas out there. And so that's one of the things that we're doing on the website is selling the seeds that we talked about in the article. So you can get some of those, and then we're sending her the money for that.
It's it sounds like it's just an excellent project, and I know I'm going to be ordering some seeds from you and to naturalize around here. So
absolutely.
Yeah,
I think that when it comes to the, you know, to the seeds that are not GMO and that are not hybridized and the medicines that are the natural medicines, I think that it's just important to keep these traditions and these skills alive for the time being, because there is so little knowledge left of them, and it will be very useful knowledge, you know, in the future when the machine isn't here to take care of anyone anymore and can't take care of people anymore. We'll need to have all of those things. I mean, it can feel sort of like you know, I think to a lot of people, they would consider this kind of thing to be, oh, well, that's kind of a cute hobby, you know, herbal medicine or you know, old-fashioned plants. So that's kind of cute. It's like, well, maybe it isn't much more than cute right now, but in the future, it'll be absolutely essential, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that's part of you know, our personal mission with this is just keep these things going, you know, for the people in the future, you know, our grandchildren or whoever, whose, you know, survival is going to depend on these skills and these seeds not having disappeared in the meantime.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah, and it's also a spiritual practice, too. I mean, for me, when I go out and I gather my herbs in the spring and summer, it is a spiritual practice. And I just, my opinion is we just can't lose these ways. They're way too valuable. I mean, how many hundreds of thousands of years did it take humanity to figure out what we can eat, you know?
Exactly. That was a lot of trial and error, I would imagine, you know, down through the generations.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, for First Nations people, that this was a way of life.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't cute. It wasn't a fad. It wasn't a hobby. It was a way of life.
Mm-hmm.
And life being the key word.
Yeah. Since most of us like to live.
Yeah.
Oh, my. Well, I have thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed talking with you tonight, Calibri, and I'm so glad that you could make it onto the show, and I thank you very much.
Well,
I really appreciated it very much. Thank you very much for having me on.
Yeah, well, and I'm sure that we'll probably have you back on again later on sometime, and we'll hear a little bit more about the hoop. So,
yeah, well, give Granny a call and have her on the show again before I come on again.
Oh, she'd be on the show. That'd be wonderful. We'll do.
Yeah,
we'll get her on the show. All right.
Okay,
everybody, that's our show for tonight. And Sylvie, do you have anything else to add before we close?
No, just glad everybody could be with us and look forward to having you on, you know, join us again.
Yep, join us next Thursday, and we'll be back here. So good night, everybody. Good night, Calibri, and good night, Tom and Aubrey.
Good night, everyone.